online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, rum has hit the big time. Richard Seal, master distiller and blender at Four Square Distillery, tells me about the sense of place that defines rum from Barbados. He is celebrated for innovation, but he doesn't actually like the word. We'll find out why. Richard Seal represents the fourth generation to work in the family-run business at Four Square Distillery. His great-grandfather, Reginald Leon Seal, founded the distribution company R.L. Siegel & Co. in Bridgetown in 1926. Richard joined the family craft in 1993. And innovation has been his watchword over the years since. It's fair to say he's been a man on a mission to shake up the rum industry. Seal has been named the IWSC's industry champion for 2023. That's the evolution of the role of president in honour of his work with rum. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now from Barbados. Welcome to the Drinking Hour, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great pleasure. I'm looking forward to chatting. I touched on the family history there, those four generations of your family. Fair to say then that rum kind of runs in your blood.
Yes. I mean, rum, the significance of rum to the business has obviously grown. You know, the history in the West Indies with rum is not wholly dissimilar to Scotch whiskey. And when you think of Scotch whiskey, you think of the blender brands. They were sort of merchants and traders and grocers, and, you know, in the same way we only know of them now as whiskey. You know, my great-grandfather would have started what would have been a wholesale trading operation, and rum would have been a essential commodity trading. But certainly, yes, it was always a key part of the business and growing up in the business. So yeah, I grew up in rum, not necessarily to be involved specifically in rum or rum making, but certainly you grow up in the family business and you certainly are well aware of the world of rum. And of course, rum is very pervasive in Barbados culture anyway. So
I'm curious about the weight of expectation that there must be on you growing up, that pressure to take on the family business. Is that something that you really felt?
Oh, yes. There was no question that I was expected to take on the family business. But as they say, I wasn't necessarily expected to be involved in depth in rum or rum making. I mean, my father, for example, will tell you he's not, he was never involved in rum making. There were, during his, he always had blenders, and, he was sales and marketing, that was his side. And I could have very easily been, a person who went to work in a suit and studied sales figures rather than been involved in distilling. So yeah, there was a tremendous expectation of joining the business. And that actually was in itself interesting, because my great-grandfather and grandfather's days, being a sort of small wholesale merchant, it's a very, very small business. And much of the next generation, the business would be a stepping stone to, the next generation having the education to become a doctor or a lawyer or a banker. And I think my grandfather would have much preferred if my father had become a banker or something like that. And then he just sort of quietly retired. And that's why many of the original Robic Street businesses, which is where we all were, again, very English style, all the same businesses on the same street. many of them have disappeared, and he would have happily gone in retirement. My father was very successful in business. And I think in his case, because he was very successful in business, he was the opposite. He was like, he was very proud of the business, and he really wanted the next generation to continue it. Whereas, as they say, I'm sure my grandfather would have been very happy if he had become a doctor or a lawyer and moved on. So yes, I was very much raised with this expectation that I will join your family business. And there was a little bit of an odd catch to that. So my father did not join the family business immediately. Again, as I say, I'm sure my grandfather would have preferred him to do something else. So he worked outside and then he joined. And so he felt that it was vital that, one, you do join the family business, but you must seek experience somewhere else first. So that was the expectation which I was raised. Like, you shall join the family business, but not right away.
So what did you do then to get that?
So basically, knowing that I was going to have to join this, obliged to join this family business, I made one of the best decisions I think I, in any sphere of what do I do next? And it will seem odd to you, but knowing I needed to learn about business, I joined then, as you could in those days, it's much more formal now, I joined a firm of chartered accountants, and the view was to learn business. And back then, it's much better for learning business as you do now. I mean, if you join a firm of, you know, chartered accountants in London, you end up being highly, highly specialized. You might work in one specific area, and you might work in, you know, insurance or something like that. But whereas joining a firm of chartered accountants in Barbados in the late 80s, you know, you might work in insurance today, you might work on a client that was retail tomorrow, you might work in a next week in a client that was manufacturing. And it really was the single greatest business education I think I could have ever have got. And so what happened then is when I joined the family business, I had tremendous confidence that I was coming in with some skills. And then, of course, that really did assist when we then made those big steps to invest in Foursquare and invest in a distillery there, because, you know, it was yours truly who did all the business plan and the application to the bank and all. None of those things I could have done without that experience. So my father was absolutely correct to send me out, even if I ultimately never have to look at do any more bookkeeping ever again or a business plan. Yeah, that was absolutely essential.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it makes a lot of sense, although it's something that I think doesn't always happen in family businesses. Quite often, it's just skips from one generation to the next without that process of going into the outside world and getting a new discipline. So you got your accountancy background, your business background, but then you decided to get your hands dirty, or at least sticky, and get properly involved in the blending and so forth.
So what happened there again was just all timing. So when I joined the business in 93, my father had made what was then the most significant investment the business had ever done, which was he had acquired what was known as the sort of the House of Allenarthur. And so by that time, there were, if you might say, four entities in rum in Barbados. And that purchase moved it to three. So that's when we acquired, like, for example, the Martin Dorley brand, very famous brand, very legendary brand in the island. That really changed our business because we acquired this, you know, brand that was more prestigious than any brand we'd had. More age rum, had a legacy of export. But it was all in trouble. I mean, this is basically why it sold. What happened is it was a bit of a sad situation. Allenarthur had acquired Dorley's in the 70s, and they didn't do a very good job with it. They were sort of focused on their own brand anyhow, so it had been struggling for a little bit. And then Allenarthur itself, which was part of a larger conglomerate, was in financial trouble. The group was in financial trouble. So it was selling off assets, and this is how we came to acquire it. Because the group itself was in trouble. And so we purchased this. So I joined in sort of, you know, and fresh with my my business skills. And he's made this huge investment. And of course, we have to make a success of it. And so the key element of making a success of it is, one, we have to invest in age stock. And two, in a scale at which we've never done. I mean, we've always, you know, majority of rum sold in the island is unaged. And for a small trader like us, the majority of the rum in our portfolio would be unaged. So suddenly now we acquire these brands, which are historically only associated with Ageron. So now if you want to build these brands, you've got to build the stock. You can't just say, and this is one of the things I think people don't really understand about the spirits business, this sort of gap between you can't just, okay, I've bought this brand, I'm going to turn this brand around tomorrow. If this brand is a brand that sells, you know, even just five-year-old rum, well, you can't have more five-year-old rum tomorrow. You can only have it 5 years from now. So you can't just take a brand and decide, well, I'm going to fix the brand, or I'm going to explore new export markets with this brand. You can only do what is physically, what stock is there in your warehouse. And so the only way you're going to succeed with this acquisition is to develop aged stocks. And you've also got to control your quality. So it's not a question of going out and purchasing. You've got to control your quality. You've got to develop the aged stocks. And as I say, so this acquisition changes our focus in terms of building aged stocks. And for the first time, we really think about exporting. We really think beyond, which is really, it seems so obvious now, but you know, when you're a business and you have a local product, it's not obvious to you that it's an export product, because exporting is really very significantly different a business than selling locally. So what then happens, and that's when I say to my father, well, we have to build a distillery. And the initial plan is we're going to build it at Hopefield, where our bottling facility is. And the problem is that we need a big supply of good water. A mile away from Hopefield is Foursquare, this closed sugar factory. So if I remember the conversation, I sort of say to my father, you know, he says, "Ah, well, what about the water?" And I said, "Well, we could pump it a mile away from Foursquare." And then he says, "Well, why don't we just put the distillery at Foursquare?" And so then that begins the investigation, and to this very old distillery had been shut for 6 years, but it was in terrible condition because it had been running down before it was closed. So basically, as I joined the business, we make, as they say, this is how it leads to this enormous step. And my father basically says, "Look, I'm not a technical person. If we're going to have a, you know, if we're going to acquire Foursquare and build a distillery, it's at you."
So who was your influence then when it came to the craft side? You've talked about the business acumen, where that came from, but who was giving you the insight?
By this time, we had two senior rum blenders. So they were an important element, because I don't think I would have been brave enough to do that without sort of having this sort of experienced crew behind me, you know, to this sort of confidence of what the distillery produces, is it going to be good enough? I mean, by that time, obviously, I'm very inexperienced, but I feel very confident I had this crew. And as you say, aging, you know, we've done aging rum for years. It's just not on a big scale. So, you know, we think we know, certainly my blenders know about aging. We just don't have thousands of barrels. We just have dozens rather than thousands. So we think we know our way around aged rum, okay. But yeah, it's just having an experienced crew, just feeling, having the confidence to do it. In other words, you know, people do get fixated on the idea of distilling as a skill in itself, and that is not entirely wrong. But the greater skill is knowing the product out the still. You know, that's what you have to know. That's what you have to know, whether this is a good distillate, this is going to mature well. If you don't have that, it doesn't give a... You could be the best in distilling engineer in the world, and it means nothing.
You're synonymous with the premiumization of rum. Just explain to a rum novice, and that probably includes me, by the way. I'm more of a grape spirit kind of guy by background and a wine guy. So just explain to someone like me what makes a great rum.
Well, let me just take a step back. Rum has always been premiumized. In fact, I would say rum's been premiumized as, you know, rum was bigger before Scotch whiskey was bigger. You know, Irish whiskey is older than Scotch whiskey in terms of popularity. So rum has a very, very long history, and has a very, very long history of premiumization. I mean, we can see prizes for rum being won in the 19th century, and then, of course, through the early 20th century. You know, we have very famous rums, very famous rums out of Jamaica, very old rums. So, you know, that's kind of a source of frustration when people talk of premiumization of rum as if it's some sort of novelty. It's been around for a long time. The problem that rum has had is that in the modern era, which of course shapes people's perception, is the leading brands are not premium and they're not high quality. And this kind of sets the tone of rum. And rum is also a bit odd for a long time, where if you wanted to see the premium, the best rums, they were in, you know, Barbados or in Jamaica, but they weren't exported. You know, this has been for a long time like this. So your image and perception of rum outside would have been very different. So one of the things that we've tried to do is not premiumization of rum in of itself, but to make these more premium rums more available. And what we tend to do is we don't really go after a rum audience, because the rum audience abroad is a very different market. The rums we're selling, no disrespect to any brand, but you know, if you're a spice rum drinker, we're not for you. You know, we're not your alternative product. So this is a kind of the oddity with rum, is that when we're selling the rums that we're selling, we're more going after sort of a Scotch whiskey audience in UK or over in the US, a bourbon audience. We're not trying to upgrade that person who is drinking, you know, a spice rum or something like that. That's a, you know, it's a completely different product. So kind of as sort of your question, the parallels again with rum and the great age spirits they're identical. The principles are the same. You know, you're making a distillate, and in that distillate, you're trying to capture the essence of the raw material. And when you're maturing, you're trying to evolve that product and add the complexity that aging brings. So that's obviously with the evolution of the spirit and the extraction of the wood and all the, you know, the wonderful, you know, mouthfeel and length and grip and everything that aging brings. That's why we find it very easy to come to a Scotch whiskey audience, single malt Scotch whiskey audience, or come to a bourbon audience and bring our rums, because there's so much familiarity there. It's just a different flavor profile. But the markers of a quality spirit, you know, that length and the grip and the complexity of flavor, all of them are very recognizable to the drinker. So that's the audience we go for. As I say, we have no interest in sort of badgering somebody drinking an inexpensive spice rum and telling you they need to upgrade. I mean, that's not our audience.
And therefore, a sense of place is just as important in a rum as it is in a single malt or a cognac, for example, or an Armagnac.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you look at rum, you are looking at, you know, arguably the most diverse spirit category. And the reasons behind that are far more interesting than the reasons that are often touted. So the diversity in rum is really tied very much to the social and economic history of the islands. And so it's quite fascinating how this, because if you came to sort of rum making in the sort of early 18th century, you'd probably find much more similarity between the rums from the different, you know, sort of the Barbados rum or Jamaica rum, you'd probably find they were quite similar in the early 18th century. And we say this because we look back at the methods and the records and stuff like that. But now you have this tremendous diversity between, say, the rums of somewhere like Barbados or Demerara or Martinique and Guadeloupe or Jamaica, and you have this wonderful diversity. And the reasons behind it, as I say, are really integrally tied to our social and economic history. If effectively, economics is at the root of everything. And it's really how people adapt and change to these economic forces that are sprung upon them. It's really how the styles evolve. So, yeah, I mean, the sense of place or terroir is tremendous. And I sometimes like to explain, you know, I really, as I say, these reasons are much greater. I mean, so, for example, if you walk into a Foursquare, obviously you see a pot still. And I try to explain to people to get across to them, you're not seeing a pot still just because, you know, the massive distiller decided, oh, I like pot stills. you're seeing a pot still at a distillery in Foursquare or a distillery at Mahangay because Barbados has been making rum since the 1640s. It's a much more substantive reason than just, I like the taste of pot still rum.
What defines the Barbados style then?
So the modern Barbados style, and when we use the word modern, we're talking about 100 odd years, was really, as I say, developed about, you know, around the turn of the century. And and you can see you'll see the parallels with blended whiskey. It was basically the advocate of the column still. But that even doesn't tell the whole story. The column still becomes a big part of our rum-making culture in the same way that the column still becomes a part of whiskey-making culture or Scotch whiskey-making culture. Not getting enough attention on this is the raw material side. So you don't have grain whiskey unless you've got the abundance and availability of grain. And the column still comes around in the islands roughly the same time we're doing central factories. And by central factories, and let me explain, if you go back far enough, it's not too far, every sugar plantation on the island was not only a agricultural operation, but was an industrial operation. They grew their cane and they made their sugar. Centralization, Barbados was a bit late to centralization, but centralization came around the turn of the 20th century, and that's where instead of sugar plantations crushing all their own cane, they sent to central factories. So the advent of the central factory now is, of course, producing sugar on an industrial scale. It's also producing molasses on an industrial scale. So if you're a clever entrepreneur in the turn of the century, and you want to put in a column still, which of course is now on a same footprint and going to make significantly more volume of molasses, rum. But of course you also need to have significant volumes of molasses feed in it. And the advent of such a central factory is going to make that available. And I think there's not enough attention is paid to the raw material side in the development of the column still. So what happens in Barbados is the column still comes in, and it wipes out, at that time in Barbados, there was two kinds of rums being sold, both from pot still, single distilled or double distilled. And the single distilled was the lower, the more common, and the double distilled was the kind of the better, more expensive. And the column still comes in and wipes out the single distilled stuff, because they sell it cheaper. But the blenders, and of course there's a little bit of a debate, you know, who started it first? Did Scotland start it first? Or did we start it and teach the Scots? Or did the Scots start it and teach us? But the blenders know to put together this lighter column still spirit with a double distilled pot still spirit in the modern Barbados rum style is born. This becomes the most popular. And, you know, eventually by 1980s, you can't find a pure pot still rum anymore. It's all blends. So that's really what happened. So I will tell you honestly, a Barbados rum today is different from a Barbados rum of 200 years ago, because the modern Barbados style was really created about 100 years ago. When you look at the history of the islands, this is what you see. You see these economic forces coming in, forcing changes, and blenders and drinkers adapting. And so you have a whole other story over in the French Islands with how they respond to centralization. And so you have all these great stories, and it explains how you get to where what you're drinking today.
And do you blur the lines between rums made from cane juice and from molasses?
Yes. So very much related to that story. So if you went to a rum making estate in Barbados before this sort of revolution, rum was made on the sugar estate, and it was made from both molasses and juice. And in fact, by the late 19th century, because Barbados molasses was quite valuable, Barbados to molasses was a bit like Demerara to sugar. We had a particular theme for our molasses. Molasses was very sparingly used in rum. And in these days, before the development of specific varieties of cane and much more sophisticated cane breeding, they would have fields of cane that, you know, weren't so good at making sucrose, and so they would get diverted to making rum. So there was no such thing in this era as a molasses rum or a juice rum. And as I say, because of centralization, what happened is, you know, central factories took the place of sugar estates. And by, you know, early 20th century, well, from about 1930s. I think there would have been two left early 20th century, and I think by the 1930s there's just one sugar estate left making rum. That's Malengay. There's no more, you know, there's no more sugar estates making rum because of centralization. And Malengay itself is also not crushing its own cane anymore. It's getting from the central sugar factory right next door, which is actually in the same ownership. So the ability for a rum maker to make from molasses and juice is now impossible. And of course, the central sugar factory has abundant quantities of molasses. So the modern Barbados rum becomes 100% molasses rum. And that's why today we associate Barbados as a molasses rum. And we do the same thing with Jamaica. Even though in Jamaica there are distilleries like Hampden who never moved away from this model and have always made rum from juice and molasses. So one of the reasons, so when we refurbished Foursquare in 1994, we were making rum again in 96, we were an oddity in a historical sense. Let me explain. We had resurrected a historical sugar estate which had made rum 100 years before. But we're doing it with a modern model of the molasses coming externally. So in other words, the molasses is not coming from the sugar cane grown around Foursquare. It's coming from the other local central sugar factories, or sadly, also in the case of Barbados, is imported as well. So one of the things I wanted to do was to re-blur that line, so that I could say to you, no, Foursquare doesn't make a molasses rum. It doesn't make a sugarcane rum. It makes a Barbados rum. So I wanted to re-blur that line. And the other thing that we wanted to do, which is also what Malengay is doing, is to re-establish the link between the fields of the distillery and the distillery. So that's what Nicholas has done. That's what Malengay is doing and has been doing for the last several years. And that's what we're working on as well. So when centralization came, not only did it switch Barbados to being this kind of 100% molasses rum maker, it broke that link between distillery and the field where the cane was grown. That link was broken. And what's happening now is us and Malengay and Nicholas, we're all trying to reestablish that link.
It's really interesting that you're doing that, and that terroir link and provenance is so important to a modern consumer, especially of something with a premium status. You've also invested very heavily in technology, so precision control of fermentation, distillation under vacuum pressure. Tell us what you've done in terms of improving that production process.
So you introduced me with that word innovation, and I cringe here because I hate that word.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hate that word. It's the most abused word in our spirits industry. You know, some guy comes up, you know, marketing comes up with a silly idea, and then it's boasted as innovation. Someone calls up their barrel broker and puts a spirit in a different barrel for 6 months, and then they want to be patted on their back that they're great innovators. Come on, please. So I hate that word because it's abused. My approach has always been to follow the principles and stick to the principles and stick to the traditional methods. And my argument is, but there's nothing wrong with trying to execute them very, very well. So when we take something like vacuum distillation, we are still distilling, and my new pot still is, actually my new pot still is a pretty good example of what we're trying to do. So we now have three stills. We have two pot stills and one column still. But I can probably describe our approach really, really well with the newest one. Obviously, it was the newest one, so it must reflect who we are. So in this pot still, we have a traditional double retort pot still. And that's a whole other podcast in itself. Why does the Caribbean use double retort pot stills? I do a whole seminar on that. But let's take that as granted now. The rum makers have their own style of pot still, which is true, double retort. I take the double retort pot still. Let's even take a little step back. If you want to see, you know, spirit pot still distillation in its most original form. You know, you can look at, you know, cognac. Cognac, you're still going to see, you know, fire, even though it's, well, modern fire. And, you know, worm tubs. And then you go over to Scotland, and there's two big evolutions over in Scotland. One is the shell and tube heat exchanger, and the other is steam. When you look at the Caribbean double retort, there's further evolutions in the development of the double retort. But what we've done there is we've gone a couple of steps further. So one way of doing it, one things we've done is doing it on a vacuum. So the whole process runs. It's the same double retort pot still. It's been in place for nearly 200 years. But instead of distilling atmosphere, we distill in a vacuum. The copper materials are much more advanced than the traditional copper materials. Because one of the things we're trying to do is to improve the catalytic effect of the copper. And then the heating system, well, we have a twin heating system. So we have, you know, it's not fire. It's not just steam coil, but a steam coil and a bain-marie. In many ways, when you look at our double retort, it's absolutely identical to a double retort of 200 years ago. But it's got these features that just means it executes very, very well. Sometimes I point out, for example, so in the distillery, we have two fermentation areas. So we have the molasses fermentation area and the cane juice fermentation area. So when you're in the cane juice fermentation area, sorry, when you're in the molasses fermentation area, I will describe it to you as modern fermentation. And by modern, I mean 100 years old. So in other words, we get the molasses in, we add yeast. So it's a cultured yeast, we add yeast. This is modern. And yes, this control, temperature control, et cetera, et cetera. So this is modern. But the principle of selecting a yeast and adding it and in a way of producing a controlled way of reliably producing this molasses wine is a modern, you know, it's 100 years old. But if you go in the cane juice area, we do natural fermentation. So this is fermentation as it was done 400 years ago. We had nothing. We had no yeast, nothing. It's completely natural fermentation. And one of the things I love to do is to point to people and say, well, there is one bit of modern technology in here. Can you see it? And, okay, for the listeners, you can't see it because you're not seeing it. And most people get it. It's quite good. And it's that the tanks are stainless steel. So I'm doing it 400 as it was 400 years ago, but I'm not using an old wooden tank because I have the knowledge and understanding to know that wood is going to create me problems with the bacteria that I don't want. It's going to create me problems with the cleaning. It's going to make cleaning harder. So I have modern knowledge, which I'm going to apply to my 400-year-old fermentation principles. So I love to point that out. It's something so simple as a stainless steel tank. Say, look, that's how you take a 400-year-old principle, but you execute it better with modern, dread the word, innovation. So that's what I like to do. I like to show you, as I say, my double retort, which has been around in rum making. Double retort, but it's been around in my rum making since the early 19th century. But here mine's on the vacuum. It's got clever copper. It's got a clever heating system. Of course, it's got clever, you know, instrumentation. But we're still doing it in principle the same way as hundreds of years. We're just trying to execute it as well as we can.
Is there a word that you prefer to innovation then?
Well, innovation is, there's nothing really wrong with the word innovation, but you have to really recognize innovation. True innovation is hard. It's not calling up your barrel broker and ordering a different barrel. And it becomes pervasive in the industry. So you can say, for example, you know, was the column still an innovation? Yes, because it's become pervasive in the industry. So that's how you tell. So, you know, was the shell and tube exchanger innovation? Yes, because it's become pervasive. So that's the hallmark of it is innovation, if it becomes adopted. Not some brand saying, you know, we're innovative because we use some, you know, silly barrel that no one will ever use again. That's not innovation. That's just BS.
There's another word, yeah, or at least an acronym.
I hate it because it gets abused, but real innovation is hard, and it's something you look back on. It takes time, and there is innovation in our industry. It's all over, but it takes time. It takes to win over people.
We've talked about the production process. We haven't yet talked about the rum boom. You know, it's been talked about, the rise of rum, for quite some time. We have now arrived at a point where rum sales are now soaring, aren't they?
Yes, and it's across the board. In other words, it's, you know, all my spice rum colleagues are just as happy, even though they're really a different product and a different audience. Yeah, and it's one of these things with a sort of positive feedback. So we've had the opportunity in recent years to bring these kind of expose people to these premium rums. You know, a big game changer was the establishment of the, you know, the UK Rum Fest in 2007. And, you know, Rum Fest all over the world followed it. But it was really much a breakthrough because it allowed, you know, small producers like ourselves to come to London and get in front of the right audience, get in front of, you know, the bartenders and the sommeliers and just get in front of people and show them rum and show them the rum they didn't know existed. And it's a positive feedback because what happens is the more they adopt the premium rum, the more we invest. And I explain this to people. I mean, we first, over 20 odd years ago, we had developed Dorley's XO, and it was perfect timing for us because we developed that and then we sort of went in the export market. And it was, as I said, this was the kind of first product we put in front of people. And it was extremely well received. It really kind of put us on the map, if you like, really kind of helped us to stand out. Oh, yes, the Foursquare, that's a good rum producer. They make that very nice Dorley's XO. It really kind of gave us that cachet. But I always explain to people, you know, the success of XO allowed us to invest and eventually come out with a Dorley's 12. The success of that allows us to invest and come out with the success of Dorley's 14. And, you know, when we started, you know, crushing cane, so we started back with cane juice back in 2016. We were sourcing it from Nicholas Abbey. Then we started crushing again in 2018. Why do we make these investments? And these, you know, and the cane juice rum is more expensive than the molasses rum. Especially when, you know, if you see my operation, it really is like a, you know, a very boutique cane crushing operation. And, you know, cane is hand cut, it's hand clean, and, you know, it's hand fed into the mill. It's really a very, very boutique operation. And why can we do this? Because we are confident that there's going to be a market for this product. And, you know, why did we make the investment in the pot still? Because people more and more want more pot still rums. They want rums with more pot still in it. They also want, you know, 100% pot still rums. So this wonderful positive feedback, you know, why is the boom coming? Well, the boom is coming largely because people are asking for the boom. You know, it's not because sometimes people, you know, say to me, well, so-and-so is coming out with another release, so they're copying you. I said, no, they're not copying me. They're responding to the audience. They might be seeing that this particular, you know, cask strength pot still rum is selling well. So they're like, okay, wow, we got an audience. So I often explain to people a lot of the things that we're doing are nothing new. You know, we've known about making rum from cane juice forever and pot stills and different casks and stuff like that. But we can invest in them at a different scale because the audience is there. So we can, you know, we always knew, for example, there may have been an audience for a cask strength rum, but we would think it was so small it was not worth it. Now we know the audience is not small. So it's a great scenario where we are. Because, as I say, we're doing these things, we're getting this wonderful positive feedback, and then that in turn is creating more and more investment. And across the rum, and I say we, I mean across the rum. So everybody's investing. Appleton is investing, Mount Gay is investing. It's really good.
As you say, rum has a long, illustrious history, but slavery has cast a dark cloud over that history as well. What do you do because slavery hasn't, you know, gone away, it's just kind of a different issue perhaps now. What do you do to ensure that when people open your product, everything is ethically in place?
Barbados is a very successful, progressive, developed country. One of the things, for example, why our sugar industry has struggled is because we have been very progressive and very successful. And so therefore, you can't pay people, thankfully, in Barbados like you can in Central America or South America. So, you know, the Barbados sugar industry has collapsed because Barbados can no longer compete on making bulk sugar. And it can no longer compete in bulk sugar because we pay and have modern environment of wage levels and working conditions. And all of that was, and actually Barbados is, you know, an amazing success in that, because if you came to Barbados before the 1930s, it was one of the poorest, you know, most wretched working people, most maltreated, even in the region. We were actually not a crown colony. We had our own assembly that actually made us worse. You know, if you want to find that utopic right wing parliament, look to Barbados in the 1920s, and it eventually, inevitably, ended with the unrest in the 30s, right through the islands. The World War II delayed the reforms that were necessary, but they started the reforms that came in the 40s, and by the 1950s, we were self-governing, and we really put ourselves in on track to change things. So, you know, by the 1940s, unions were, you know, formed and allowed, and really things changed radically. And of course, one of the consequences of that is they say, yeah, we don't compete on the, you know, the commodities that depend on paying people, you know, $200 a month. So Barbados, we are very proud of the environment in which we operate. You know, sometimes people, and it sometimes can be a little bit insulting, because people will come and say, well, you know, they sort of assume that I'm working in some underdeveloped third world country. And so it's like, well, what do you do? Well, I follow the law, because the law in Barbados is very good. You know, we have, especially when I get any questions from my friends in America, because I sort of remind them we have things like paid maternity leave and paid holidays of, you know, 3 weeks and longer. And generally, Barbados is a very progressive and very successful society. Of course, is everything perfect? Of course not. But this is the thing. When I speak as Foursquare, really, I speak as a Barbadian and speak of coming from a country that's done very, very well. We, on the UN Development Index, I think we are in the whole Western Hemisphere, this sort of North America and South America, this side, I think we're third or fourth. Yeah, so that's really the situation. Barbados is, we've done very, very well. We have tremendous, you know, high level of literacy, high level of education, and very, very good progressive labor laws and strong unions.
And your sourcing, you know, comes from within Barbados, so you're able to control that process in that respect.
Well, no. So what happens is we do get sourcing from outside, and we are too small to do it direct. The imports either are handled by West Indies or Mangay, and they are doing it with Bonsucro certified sources.
I see.
But, you know, for example, when someone comes and asks me if, you know, Barbados is Bonsucro, I feel a little insulted. It's like asking, you know, if a UK factory is Bonsucro. No, we're Barbados. We have high level of regulatory environment to people, working in Barbados.
So with that in mind, what are your ambitions for the role as industry champion for the IWSC for the next year?
So I spoke with, you know, everyone at IWSC, I was very willing to be active. I'm doing a seminar at London Wine Fair. I'm going to do that seminar. I'm sharing it with Ian Burrell. And yeah, I'm just, you know, whatever, you know, obviously we're doing this, and whatever we can do. I told him I was very willing. I was actually, we were hoping to have a seminar at Provine, but in the end it didn't work out, because what I wanted to do there was, you know, in front of a wine audience, was a discussion on really how the three distilleries, Mangay, Foursquare, and Nicholas, as I say, are returning to their roots, as I just describe it, restoring that link between the surrounding estate and the distillery, something that was broken in the 20th century. So if I get an opportunity to do a seminar on that, I will. But yeah, no, I'm still sort of chatting with, you know, Tristan as to what shall I do during my year? Because I think they're very keen for the, you know, with the evolution of the name from president to industry champion, to have someone who's more active. And I've said I'm willing. And one of the things I'm hoping to do, we do in Barbados, we put on an event. We've had it 2 years in a row, Barbados Rum Experience. And this event is, you come to Barbados for a week. There's three distillery tours, but they're very special VIP tours. And then we put on seminars as well. You know, nearly all of the seminars are from people independent of distilleries. So we have professional historians. It's a very, very high level event. And so the plan is to have some IWSC people come to that, because it's really, I mean, if there's one way in which you can have a sort of crash course in Barbados rum and Barbados rum distilleries, we did attend the Barbados Rum Experience first week in November.
Well, you'll make a great double act with Ian Burrell at the London Wine Fair, I'm confident.
Yeah, we've done a few events together and we always generally have good fun.
Yeah, I bet. Talking of good fun, just finally, we always ask our guests for a desert island drink. So if you're stuck, I mean, you're not quite on a, you're on a Caribbean island rather than a desert island as such. But if you were stuck on a desert island and you could have one drink, and it can be one of your own, that's absolutely fine. What would you choose?
That's a terrible question to ask me.
I know it's an evil one, but it's a question nonetheless.
So people, I'm gonna skirt it slightly. I'm gonna be smart. So people, I get that also. Like, what's your favorite drink, your favorite rum? And I say, I don't have a favorite, but I'll explain to you something that's very, very important, and which I've touched on already, and that would be Dorley's XO. We developed Dorley's XO, and it's kind of the first one that was, you know, developed in my time. Obviously, we sell rums that were existed long before me. And we did it actually with local market in mind, but it was perfect timing. And we just went on we sort of got the breakthrough to go in the export market right after we developed it. And as I say, it really put us on the map. And so that rum will sort of always have that special place. As I explained, nothing comes after without the success of that one. So if someone comes and says to me, you know, they love Foursquare Isonomy and, you know, it's the greatest rum they ever had, well, it wouldn't exist if people didn't drink Dorley's XO and made a success of it for us. So that would be the rum I take, because it has that special meaning.
Okay, well, that's definitely an answer. I don't think you skirted that after all. So, and it is a bugger of a question. I think I would probably struggle to answer it myself, but I enjoy asking it. So it's a great pleasure to talk to you, Richard. I've learned a lot myself, actually. So hopefully those listening have too. And I'm sure there'll be much to glean from your session at the London Wine Fair in a few months' time as well. So we wish you the best for that and for your year as industry champion at the IWSC. And thank you very much for joining us on The Drinking Hour.
Thank you very much as well for having me. It's my pleasure.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode, in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
Let's finish off, as ever, with some medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame. These from the 2022 process, though we will shortly have winners from the 2023 judging sessions, which have been taking place over recent weeks. Looking forward to those. Today, the focus is on rum, fairly obviously. So let's start with one from Richard Stable, R.L. Seal & Co. Dorley's 14-year-old rum. Dorley's, the heritage brand acquired by Seal, he made reference to it earlier on. It won a gold medal with 95 points. The judges were led by Ian Burrell, a former guest here on The Drinking Hour, episode 83. A wonderful chat, really enjoyed that. So do listen if you didn't get the chance. And here is the judging team's tasting note for this Dorley's 14-year-old gold medal winner. Bold and intense nose with aromas of honey and orange. Full and rich mouth feel. Dark chocolate, nutmeg and a twist of lemon. Sherry and dried fruit on the finish. another of Richard's babies, Four Square Indelible Rum. This one, a strong silver, 94 points, just shy of gold. An 11-year-old single blended rum matured in ex-Bourbon and Zinfandel casks. A combination of pot and column stills, if that talk fascinated you earlier. Here's the tasting note. Golden syrup, nose, with dried fruit, Christmas cake and sherry. Well-integrated and complex palate with a warming finish. Talking of Ian Burrell, he co-founded the Equiano brand, and he told us about the inspiration for the name on that episode, 83. We featured the brand's gold medal winner when we spoke to him, but there was also a silver for Equiano Light Rum. Here's the judging panel's tasting note. French pastry aromas lead on the nose with a softly balanced mouthfeel, partnered with lovely vanilla and tropical fruit characters on the palate. And let's stay in Barbados for the rest of our selections. Mount Gay XO Triple Cask Blend Rum. Mount Gay, another of the great names referenced by Richard earlier too. They're just down the road. This one, a strong silver with 93 points. The tasting note, sweet caramel and fruit on the nose. The palate exudes smoothness and balance through a lovely integration of spice and baked fruit. And finally, here's one from M&S, Marks & Spencer Bajan Estate XO Barbados Rum, a silver medal winner, 92 points, twin barrel aged, this one. The judges said, an exuberant display brimming with juicy pineapple, ripe banana and sweet coconut. There's a wonderful weighty mouthfeel and great balance between deep woody flavours and sweeter, fruitier notes. And I'm all for fruity notes. That's it for another edition of The Drinking Hour. My thanks to Richard Seal. Best of luck to him in his year as industry champion at the IWSC. You can follow us at Food FM Radio on Instagram and Twitter. And I'm Mr. Venusaurus on Instagram and Twitter. See you next time. For now, goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.